There's a story that the great American poet Wallace Stevens, who lived in Connecticut, died in 1955, and made his living as a very successful insurance company executive, used to dream up poems in his head while walking to the office each workday. When he got to work, he'd recite the poem aloud so that his secretary could type it out, or at least a first draft anyway. One classic Stevens poem, which may or may not have originated during one of those morning walks, is The Emperor of Ice Cream.
Call the roller of big cigars, the muscular one, and bid him whip in kitchen cups concupiscent curds. Let the wenches dawdle in such dress as they are used to wear, and let the boys bring flowers in last month's newspapers. Let be finale of seam. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream. Take from the dresser of deal, lacking the three glass knobs, that sheet on which she embroidered fantails once, and spread it so as to cover her face. If her horny feet protrude, they come to show how cold she is and dumb. Let the lamp affix its beam. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. What is a museum? More importantly, who gets to decide? In the summer of 2016, the Museum of Ice Cream opened in New York City as a temporary experience dedicated to the concept and culture of ice cream. The idea for such a museum was met almost immediately with both widespread interest and skepticism. By late 2017, more than 500,000 guests had experienced the original Manhattan-based iteration. Subsequent pop-ups happened in LA, Miami, and San Francisco, where the museum now has its first permanent space. We recently sat down with Madison Utendahl, the Museum of Ice Cream's head of content and social. She's been there since the beginning, and in many ways, is still just getting started. I'd like to start with just the basic idea of what the Museum of Ice Cream is. And I've heard it described as a brand experience. But even that is a little bit esoteric. But what is that?
Absolutely.
In terms, you know, and something that people could understand easily. How do you get that across?
So the way that I describe it is that Museum of Ice Cream is an experiential installation dedicated to ice cream. But the whole premise and foundation of Museum of Ice Cream is an experience that has been created to foster connection and imagination using ice cream as a vehicle to bring people together.
And so the idea was born when, at what time? You know, it's kind of blown up fairly quickly, but where was the seed for the whole thing planted?
Yeah, so the idea, Mary Alice Bunn, who's the founder of Museum of Ice Cream, this has been a lifelong childhood dream of hers. She basically always wanted to create experiences that would bring people together, and she noticed throughout her childhood the significance that ice cream played in her life and bringing her family and friends together, whether it was over, you know, after a dinner or, you know, after playing a sports game or for a holiday. She just had this really strong connection to ice cream as a child. And so as a result, has always wanted to create this large scale experience where ice cream was at its core. And the idea came to life about 2.5 years ago, when she finally decided that she was going to quit her job and put all of her passions into this project. And I've been fortunate enough to have known her for a couple of years and to have been a part of this journey since day one.
So when she came to you and said, I have this dream to open a museum of ice cream, I want you to quit whatever you're doing or whatever path you're currently
right,
on
right, yeah.
and come on this journey with me. Was that something that you immediately hopped onto and said, yes, I can't wait? Or were you like, what is this going to be? What was your initial reaction to the pitch?
It was twofold. I'm somebody who I've been very fortunate to have joined and been a part of incredible projects throughout my career that have started off of this premise of, I have no idea what I'm doing. Will you join me? And they have somehow worked out. So I think she knew that I would be excited to jump into something that was completely foreign and unknown. So when she came to me and said to me, you know, Madison, you're a storyteller. At the time, I was the producer working at Refinery 29. Can you come and help me build out these social channels and these stories? You know, at first I was like, well, I feel very off brand. You know, the content that I cover is very serious and intense and dealing with women's rights. And it was just a very different way of telling stories as well, having it being video focused. So at first I was a little hesitant because I didn't know if I was the right person for the job, but I also was incredibly excited because I thought it was an exciting challenge to take on. I knew, considering how incredibly brilliant Mary Ellis is, she is just a total visionary and an exceptionally creative person, that there was no way that she would jump into anything if she wasn't going to do it 100% and wouldn't be putting her entire life behind it. So it was exciting. It was something I was really stoked to get behind.
You run social and content, and that sounds like
yes.
a lot. So is that basically everything going out externally from the museum?
Yeah. So it is a lot. It's a lot. I feel fortunate in that there's a great team of people that work at Museum of Ice Cream. But yes, it is everything externally facing. So whether that's a newsletter, a post on Instagram, a video you see on Facebook, that comes out of my team.
So the vast majority of people experiencing the Museum of Ice Cream are experiencing it through social channels because you have such a big reach now and it's grown so quickly. That probably is your number one avenue to reach not just your core audience, but new people as well.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide what people know already versus how to constantly reintroduce the concept? Because if you're starting right. something that's still so new, you've only been around mm-hmm. for a short time period. I'm sure people come every day to either a different platform on social or even to the physical space, which is now in San Francisco, and they need to have a little bit of backstory. How do you balance that out as far as how to entry point people into the concept?
So the way that I try to, the way that I think about all of our posts and all of our content that we do is, does it tie back to these three pillars or three tentpoles that I like to have within every single piece of content? So at one point, is it uplifting the community? So that's our external audience. Is it telling a story or connecting our audience to our team? Or is it telling a story, connecting our audience to our experience? And I find that those three things are actually entryways into understanding who we are and what we stand for. So in order to not have our posts appear repetitive or reductive, we try to break down every post to, you know, those three things. And it allows for, I think, a nice, refreshing tone to constantly be going through our accounts, and also would give somebody an interesting way of learning about who we are and what we stand for. I think there is a false narrative that gets perpetuated about Instagram and that we are an Instagrammable pop-up. But in reality is that we're now a permanent institution, and the premise of our experience is not for photos, but really to bring people together. Each post and each story is connected to that.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment in the sense yeah. of, how do you take something that could be very easily seen as kind of a surface experience and give it mm-hmm. deeper meaning? Meaning, what are the takeaways? When you're in the museum world, people love to use the term outcomes and all these different things mm-hmm. that you hear. What beyond the smile or the wow factor of the initial visual experience can people take away that it's something that's maybe not as publicized as just the
sure.
the first experience, but what are the takeaways from the museum?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing that I will say is really unique and different to Museum of Ice Cream compared to a traditional museum is that every single person who works for Museum of Ice Cream is sort of coached and trained to interact with our audience in a meaningful way. So for example, when you go through Museum of Ice Cream, the only way you are able to get from one room to the next is by interacting with a guide that is in the room. The guide is instructed to speak to the audience, to educate the audience, to provide thought-provoking questions that encourage people to really think about how they view imagination, whether or not they're currently being creative in their own lives, or they're following their own passions. And so in traditional museums, you sort of don't, unless you would sign up for a tour or take an audio guide, most of the time you don't, the security is not there to sort of foster the experience and your relationship with the artwork that you're viewing. And throughout Museum of Ice Cream, it's actually the polar opposite. The experience is enhanced through the people that exist within those installations. And it ties to our messaging of using ice cream as this vehicle that is connecting people together. So you walk into the installation, you eat the ice cream, you experience that comfort and delight, and then you're provoked to ask the question that really, really taps into, I think, subject matters that we sort of have a tendency not to think about. I think we don't really often give ourselves the opportunity to say to ourselves, when's the last time we really explored our imagination? When did we think about whether or not we're pursuing our passions? Are we being creative in any other parts of our lives? And that's really what makes us unique. That's where the depth and substance really comes out of the experience versus in a lot of these sort of Instagram pop-ups, they're designed for photos, which is, you know, perpetuates a disconnect versus we're designed to connect.
When the choice was made to call it the Museum of Ice Cream as opposed to the House of Ice Cream or the Palace of Ice Cream or whatever you want to call, that word brings with it a lot of weight. And what's been the reaction within the broader museum community? Because it's been, from what I've seen, all over the place. You know, it's up and down.
Yeah.
People, I think that word museum, people get very defensive about it in a certain sense. And when you think about traditional art museums or historic museums, the argument could be made maybe that you guys were poking fun at the concept or whatever it was. But what has been the general reaction to, I guess, what you would call peers in the museum world?
Yeah. You know, I think it's been mixed. By no means were we poking fun at the term museum. I actually studied art history in school. Manish Bora, who's the founder of, one of the co-founders of the museum, was in the art world for a very long time. And we are a contingency of people that actually very much are avid museum goers and have studied art history as a craft and education. The term museum was utilized as a means to sort of challenge and disrupt what we view as museums and keep it more open-ended and make them more accessible. So in our opinion, a lot of times museums, depending on what they are, I mean, obviously vary per institution, can feel very isolating for people. There's a certain, not everyone can walk into a museum and have an experience that feels educational or feels uplifting based upon either previous knowledge or their sort of access that they've had to be able to understand or comprehend art. I think sometimes the art world can feel a little daunting to people. And so what we really want to do is just to provide an additional opportunity for people to actually challenge this conception of what a museum is in a way that makes it feel more accessible. We hope that you go to the Museum of Ice Cream and then go to the Whitney or then go to the New Museum or SF MoMA. We're designed as a complement, if anything, not as anything antagonistic or offensive.
So when it began, you had a temporary space in New York City. Is that correct? And then recently you have opened a permanent space in San Francisco. Let's talk about scaling this thing up because the speed and pace of your growth is pretty breathtaking in a certain sense, starting with the fact that you have this permanent space in San Francisco, you're based office-wise in New York. Should we expect more permanent spaces or will there always be this one space? Will you continue doing things throughout the country or basically will you now always expect people to come to San Francisco or what kind of footprint do you want more nationwide?
Sure. Yeah, we definitely are looking into expanding and having more permanent locations throughout the country. You know, we're seeing, and I think we can see in this sort of experiential economy that has just boomed across the, you know, really, I would say globally, that people are really dedicated right now to spending their money on experiences and to doing things with the people they love or strangers that are just different. I know statistically we see, especially amongst millennials, they're spending more money on trips than they are on clothing. And in my opinion, that's incredibly exciting. And I hope that if anything, we can provide and continue to boost this experiential economy and really provide other museums, institutions, and installations with opportunities to just keep getting people through their doors. It's incredibly important. And I think that there is an incredible humanizing quality of having a unique experience together.
The museum itself, you have a truck that travels around, like a food truck or ice cream truck, right? There is the line of ice creams that are sold through Target, right?
Yeah, wow, you've done your research. Yes, absolutely.
Yes, there is the line of Sephora products and makeup products.
Yes.
I mean, so, and these things are all kind of happening all at once. I'm sure that they've been in the works for a long time and they're all kind of dropping now, but that's a lot of things on your plates at any given moment. Talk about the strategy behind the kind of commercial pursuits like makeup and selling things at Target. Is that all part of the business strategy or is that part of more of a marketing strategy or is it a little bit of both?
You know, so for us, the way that we try to, the way that we have used tapping into these products is we look at them as tools for expression. The same way that we view ice cream is a tool, it's a vehicle, and you can either choose to look at it as just a treat or you can choose to look at it as the nucleus to bring people together in many situations. And we look at our, you know, whether it's the collection, the kids collection that we had at Target or the Sephora line, if they're just further tools that people can use to express themselves, to tap into their imagination and creativity. And with ice cream at its core, ice cream is incredibly accessible and it's really a universal language and people speak it globally. They understand it and they can comprehend it. And so we're basically elevating that and providing opportunities for people across the country to be able to experience the magic of our brand. Because we're so tied to physical locations, if we don't have products out in the world, then we really are limiting ourselves. Everyone should be able to have a piece of Museum of Ice Cream that's really a part of who we are and what we stand for. So that's really the intention behind tapping into all these products.
So when you're, this is the real serious question, when you're testing out flavors for ice cream, and you're, how many flavors are available through the Target promotion that you guys have been doing?
We have about seven.
Seven flavors
available right now.
Did you guys get an opportunity to do some taste test research on some of those things to make sure that they were good enough to give to the general public?
Yes. So we actually work with this incredible food scientist. Her name is Sarah Massoni, and she's based out in Oregon. And our head of production is a woman named Gabby Yacoub. And the two of them have been working together for over a year to build out these flavors. And they've consisted of many trips across country with Gabby and Mary Alice and Sarah tasting. I think they tasted over, you know, something like 500 flavors before they chose these seven.
Somebody has
so
to do
So for them,
it.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You know, it's been quite a laborious and incredibly sweet and delicious journey. But we had some tastings in the office, and we've had focus groups and done everything we needed to do to make sure that they were not just good for our taste buds, but good for everyone.
And what's your personal favorite flavor? Do you have one?
Yeah, so, you know, I really like our churro flavor. I think it's just fun and different.
Is this kind of cinnamon? Yeah.
Yeah, it's
those really warm
it's
spices.
So good. Yeah, and there's churro chunks in it, and just the way that it's processed, the churro chunks are almost frozen in a way that when you eat it, they still have this like really great doughy, chewy taste. It's so good.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Carpet, Stoic, Unflappable, Long Suffering, Industrial. Just a few of the ways to describe the unsung, under your feet, foundational material of most museums. In a world full of easy to clean tile, wall to wall linoleum, and stained concrete, many museums remain committed to the warm comfort of carpet. Stains be damned, carpet confronts adversity and says, bring it on. Red wine reception with donors, no problem. Field trip of third graders on a rainy day, big whoop. And don't be thrown off by that nervous service dog. You got this. We at Museum Confidential wish to endorse carpet with every fiber of our being.
Can you kind of talk about, without giving away what you're going to be doing 5 years from now, you know, because it's difficult to maintain that white hot center of kind of being the hot new thing, right? And at some point, the Museum of Ice Cream won't be the hot new thing. There will be something else.
Right.
So how do you maintain relevance beyond the initial publicity?
I think it's a product of evolving and adapting and making sure that we're always have a finger on the pulse of culture. The reality is if it's always trying to be the hottest new thing, in my opinion, that doesn't allow for permanence. And we're past the point of just wanting to make an impression, but we want to make an impact. So our shift is really moving to creating and establishing ourselves as a permanent leader and thought leader, or an entity that is thought-provoking and really challenging and pushing the boundaries of what it means to experience the world. And we're using ice cream as the crux, the nucleus of that. So with that being said, you know, for the next 5 years, we're looking into cementing ourselves in culture. So that's creating experiences that really, really do transform people's relationship with their own imagination. That means moving from me personally as head of content, that's looking at what does Museum of Ice Cream look like in the digital video space? What does a Museum of Ice Cream show look like? What does Museum of Ice Cream characters look like? You know, really understanding and studying the works of brilliant institutions like Disney and how they have evolved through the years. And their whole experience started with a mouse and started with one theme park, and look what they've been able to develop. So we're in that same space.
What about the reaction or collaboration opportunities with, I guess, what I would call the ice cream industrial complex, like the actual ice cream companies, people like Häagen-Dazs or whoever? Have you guys had an opportunity to interface with any of those big companies or anything like that?
Yeah, you know, we have, but we're really, really, really proud to be privately owned and to be run by a team of 12. I mean, we are a female-led and female-dominant company, and we are going to run that wave for as long as we can. It's been an incredible journey to be able to build something like this with just incredibly strong and powerful, educated group of women. And so while we have had the opportunity to team up with some of these like big ice cream conglomerates that have the ownership of the market, we're going to stay private for now and small as long as we can.
What if someone wanted to come see the space for themselves? What are they going to get out of that that they could not get from the virtual world? What's the big takeaway in terms of, I'm going to make the time, I'm going to take the trip to go beyond my screen and go to this place in person?
It's hypersensory. So imagine, you know, going to a museum and with looking at a piece of art, you also were able to smell the, you know, the flowers that were in the studio to which the artist was crafting, you know, his or her work. And then you were able to taste the food that they were eating as well as they were designing this masterpiece. And that's how I like to say about Museum of Ice Cream, that it is so hypersensory in every way, shape, and form. You touch, feel, smell, taste. You go through every human emotion because of how hypersensory it is. So the images are powerful and they're stark and they're beautiful and captivating. But imagine looking at that incredible, vibrant sprinkle pool while also eating ice cream and also smelling cotton candy and also hearing the laughter of your friends and family and strangers. I mean, it really is a 360 fully immersive experience, and you can only really understand what that's like when you go to it.
A recent headline in the New York Times caught my eye. It reads, quote, "The existential void of the pop-up experience." The no-holds-barred piece by Times critic-at-large Amanda Hess takes on the entire notion of spaces like the Museum of Ice Cream. She writes, "I went to as many Instagrammable museums, factories, and mansions as I could. They nearly broke me." We called up Amanda to dive a little deeper.
I had heard about these pop-up experiences for a while, but I'd never been to one. And the thing that prompted me to write the piece is that I saw an ad for the Museum of Pizza, which is coming to New York later this month. And I wanted to go to it because I actually can't eat pizza. I have celiac disease, and so I can't eat gluten. And so I was interested in this idea of pizza as a concept as opposed to a food.
The idea of pizza.
The idea of pizza. And this is something that they stress in their PR materials. It's like pizza will be available, but it's not about the food. It's about the concept of pizza. So that is what initially caught my interest. We actually ended up publishing the story before the Museum of Pizza actually opened. And in that time, I went to five others.
I know that when you write a piece, you don't, you know, have control always of what the headline is. But this thing really just landed like huge in the museum world. I've been talking to so many people about it. And so I'll just kind of read this. So it's called "The Existential Void of the Pop-Up Experience." And then the subline is, "I went to as many Instagrammable museums, factories, and mansions as I could. They nearly broke me." And you certainly aren't pulling any punches. But when going into it from that first moment, from the pizza experience and leading into the five others, had you been to any of them prior to researching for this piece?
I just want to say that I actually did write that headline.
Oh, you did?
I don't always write them, but I wrote that one. I had never actually been to one before. I had seen photos of them, particularly of the Museum of Ice Cream, and I'd been to a few experiences that felt adjacent to this. Restaurants in New York that would create these big sundaes that were actually hard to eat but seemed sort of designed to take the photo of them. But going to like an actual whole experience that was created around a concept, I had not done that before. And then so I went to many of them in a short period of time, which I found to be like really exhausting, actually.
So talk about that in the terms of, you know, you talk about going to a restaurant that has like, you know, the world's largest ice cream sundae or something, like a 200-ounce steak or something. Those are, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, publicity stunts in a real traditional sense. They're doing something outrageous to try to get some attention. Also could be used as a loss leader, trying to get people in the door and break through some of the just noise and get some attention. What do you see these places doing that's either different than that or attempting to do something different than that? Do you think that their intentions run counter to what you ended up feeling?
Yeah. I mean, I think the distinction that I found is that many of these places are only the stunt. So they're often created by marketers and they kind of exist to market themselves. So the point is to go and take photos of yourself that look really nice, and those photos percolate on your feed, and then your friends see them, and they also feel drawn to this space. But because they're pop-up, often extremely temporary experiences, they both make you feel like you need to go now or you're never going to have a chance to go again, but also have no expectation that you're ever going to actually come back. And so need to deliver less than a restaurant would or a theme park.
So the you know, that often used phrase FOMO comes into play here, you know, trying to get people to act quickly. There's a sense of urgency they're trying to relay about getting in on something that will maybe never happen again. Were you a museum person growing up? Did museums mean a lot to you as a kid? Did you go to a lot of museums?
I don't think any more than anyone else. So I'm not coming from this place where I really treasure the museum and art gallery personally and, you know, am offended by the idea of these places appropriating them. I actually feel like efforts from traditional museums and curators and artists to make those experiences more accessible to people who may not have otherwise stepped into a museum are all very good. And I'm certainly someone who can go to one museum when I'm traveling, but maybe like have too short of an attention span to go to two. So it's not as if I'm on the extreme end of people who might be drawn to these frothier museums. But I did find myself offended both by the idea that these are somehow better than a real museum and better than a place like Disneyland. And the main distinction that I found, you know, with the museum is if you go to a museum or an art gallery and you see people's expressions, like people don't necessarily look like they're having a very good time because they're taking something in and they're thinking and they're really interacting with a piece. Whereas these places, you know, if you just look at the photos, it looks like the greatest possible time that you could have because everyone is posing and smiling for the camera. But I found that what at least I was actually experiencing was hardly anything.
You talk about being exhausted, and there certainly probably was a hierarchy to which places exhausted you more than others. And you spend a fair amount of time talking about the Rosé Wine Mansion. Can you explain to us what the Rosé Wine Mansion is?
The Rosé Mansion is a place in Midtown Manhattan that is filling a storefront that most recently was an accessories store. And now it is a wine-themed experience. So when you go in, you wait at the entrance, and then you go around what is essentially a simulated wine tasting in front of different kind of Instagrammable backdrops. And I found the Rosé Mansion to be both better and worse than some of the other places I went to. Better because you get what amounts to two glasses of wine as a part of your ticket price. So at least they are providing something that makes the experience slightly better. But also worse because wine is, not for me, but for many people, a real thing and a craft that they take an interest in and would like to know more about. And this place, like many of these other places, you know, instead of actually taking people on a journey that would actually give them a better understanding of how wine is made and its place in the world, pasted things on the wall that seemed like, you know, random facts printed off of Wikipedia, and made a bunch of rooms that didn't even really have anything to do with wine, but sort of evoked some aspect of wine, like rosé is pink. So there was a room that had a bunch of fake flamingos in it. And roses sound like rosé, so there was a bathtub that had fake rose petals that you could throw up into the air and take your photo with. And so while I appreciated the drinks, it was also, I think, one of the emptier experiences that I went on.
What do you think would be the difference in the experience if you took phones and photography totally out of the equation and it was supposed to be really only about the person interacting with whatever it is there, and the kind of internet culture of it and everything kind of disappeared? It was really just about the sensory experience of it or the person in the space. Would that change the core experience in any substantial way?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do have experiences that feel more like that. So an immersive theater experience like Sleep No More, for example, I think, you know, really makes use of people's presence in the space and creates this artistic experience around them. But that is not about, you know, a photo that you can take home to your Instagram feed. I think even an escape room, you know, is delivering more of a tangible experience than these places are. But I think honestly, you know, if we were to think about someone's experience in this place and time without social media, we would get a lot of the stuff that we already have, like, you know, games and rides on a boardwalk to me are infinitely more satisfying than one of these places. An art museum, infinitely, you know, more respectful of me as a human being in this space and inviting me to interact with it than, you know, some slogan about rosé that's painted on the wall.
If you were able to change something that was kind of a through line that all these places had in common and say, if you did X, Y, or Z, I would think more about this as a concept that would be interesting to me. You know, is there something that is missing? You talk about this existential void. That's a very big idea, but is there something that would create anything that could connect with you on a real important level?
I think to me, I would be interested in seeing one of these places that was created by a curator or an artist as opposed to a marketer or a lifestyle blogger, like many of them are made by. There's actually one experience that recently opened in New York that is really interesting to me, but I wasn't able to go. It didn't open until after my piece published, and it's called the Museum of Broken Windows. The New York ACLU made it as an immersive experience to inform people about policing. And so I do think, you know, there are a lot of possibilities for experiences. I think part of it is that, you know, they are so new that some of the standards have been pretty low so far. I do think they can be improved upon, yeah.
Is there anything that you think traditional museums could learn from what these places are doing? Because they're getting all the oxygen out of the room. You know, everything you're seeing and the publicity and the marketing really is kind of going crazy for that. But and I think there is a fair amount of jealousy from the traditional museum world about some of the attention these places are getting. And I think in some of those cases, they share some of the same concerns, which is, you know, this is a empty experience and it's just all surface and no, there's no there. But do you think there's anything that the Met could learn from the tactics that these places use?
That's an interesting question. So I wasn't able to make it to the Museum of Pizza because it hasn't opened yet, but I did go to a preview party that was held in a real museum, which is the New Museum. And a part of me was a little put off by that, that the new museum would sort of like open its space to what I consider to be a fake museum. But maybe it's also savvy for them to align themselves with something that is
taking
up so much oxygen.
Kind of being opportunists and saying, hey, this thing's getting all the attention. What if we partnered with them and get some of that reflected light? That's what it kind of came off to you as.
Well, now I'm thinking that that's maybe why they did it, and maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I guess I felt like it gave the Museum of Pizza this air of authentic museumness that it doesn't deserve. But, you know, it did get a lot of people to go into the new museum. You know, we all marched in there and got our free drinks and posed in front of Seamless ads. And so, you know, maybe some of those people saw something in the museum that they liked and they'll come back. I think there's always tension between, you know, the marketing and the substance. And these places, you know, they don't have to grapple with any tension because there's no substance, right? So they can be as, you know, they can market it as crazily as they want. They don't really have to deliver on anything.
Well, just finally, putting out the piece, I'm sure you've gotten a lot of reaction to it. One, have you gotten any reaction specifically from the institutions that you talk about? And two, did you worry that giving them this level of attention feeds directly into the problem in the sense of, if your argument is that these places don't have any substance and they're all about publicity, you're just giving them more publicity and there's no such thing as bad publicity from their angle?
Yeah, I haven't heard from any of them. I would be really interested to hear what the Museum of Ice Cream people have to say on your show. As for giving them more press, I write about the internet, and this is a constant tension with my work because, you know, as we all talk about ad nauseum, we live in an attention economy, and so writing about anything that has seized our attention only feeds more attention to it. I think that's a huge risk. But I also honestly felt like somebody had to say something because I'm a millennial, and I had this fear that, you know, in decades and decades, when we're all dead, like the Museum of Ice Cream is going to be seen as like our Woodstock or something. And I wanted there to be a dissenting voice that said, actually, not all of us are into this.
Yeah.
You know, and we see it for what it is. So I felt like I needed to plant that flag.
Close the shop.
American artist Wayne Thiebaud was born in 1920. It's 2018. He's still working. Often lumped in with the pop artists like Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein, Thiebaud is known most for his paintings of confections. Pies, cakes, and other sweet treats often appear in his work, sometimes in multiples, evoking the feeling of being in line at a cafeteria, tray in hand, making selections from an assortment of choices. Growing up in Long Beach, California, Thiebaud worked for a short time at a little cafe called Mile High and Red Hot, the Mile Highs being ice cream and the Red Hots referring to hot dogs. He would later paint countless images of both. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
Let be finale of seem. The only emperor is the emperor of ice cream.